From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the creator of the World Wide Web, we talk with Tim Berners-Lee. He's been called the unsung hero of the Internet. He now directs the Web Consortium at MIT, which is developing standards for the web. And say, got a vegetable that needs dicing or a bald spot that needs to be concealed? Ron Popeil's got the product for you. We'll talk with Popeil, TV's most famous salesman, who's built a fortune hawking such products as the Vegematic and the GLH Great Looking Hairspray. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Primary Colors, the anonymously written novel about the Clinton campaign that's got everyone guessing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Investigators say lightning may have caused the crash of a Boeing 757 with 189 people on board. The charter jetliner was carrying German tourists home from the Caribbean. It crashed into the waters off the Dominican Republic late yesterday. Today, there are no signs of survivors. 28 members of the Clinton administration have been subpoenaed by a House committee in connection with the White House travel office firings. UPI's Pye Chamberlain has details.
The House Government Operations Committee issued the subpoenas to presidential advisors and the Justice Department. Committee Chairman William Clinger, a Republican of Pennsylvania, has said he is trying to determine if the FBI and the IRS were misused in the dismissal of the employees. He says they were fired because the White House wanted to give the travel office business, basically airplane charters for the traveling White House press, to a company involving a friend of the president's named Harry Thomason. Pye Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Bosnian Croats in the divided southern city of Mostar have violently demonstrated against plans by the local European administration to redraw boundaries separating the Muslim and Croat communities. From Zagreb, Richard Carruthers reports.
The demonstration occurred after the European administrator in Mostar, Hans Košnik, proposed new boundaries between the Muslim and Croat sectors, including one area of joint control. A crowd of Croats surrounded his car, some jumping on it, shouting, "Hang him, kill him." Shots were fired, though no injuries were reported, and demonstrators ransacked the European Union offices. The Croatian mayor in Mostar has rejected Košnik's map, saying that the Dayton Accord proposed three distinct areas of control for Muslims and Croats. He also said he was breaking off all contact with the European Union administration, which has been trying to reunify the city since the Croat-Muslim War ended 2 years ago. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
Military officials say a memorial service is set for Friday for the American soldier killed in Bosnia last week. Sergeant First Class Donald Dugan will be honored at the Army base near Frankfurt, Germany. Dugan was killed in an explosion while on duty in Bosnia, but there's still no official report on what happened. Phil Graham is in Iowa today, where he had hoped to build on the momentum of a win in the Louisiana caucuses, but rival Republican presidential candidate Pat Buchanan took most of the votes in the Bayou State yesterday. Graham, meanwhile, is facing angry farmers in Iowa who want to know why he wasn't in Washington voting on a key provision in the farm bill. And for the first time in its modern history, power changed hands peacefully on the island of Haiti. René Préval was sworn in today as president, replacing Jean-Bertrand Aristide. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up almost 16 points at 5475.87, volume 362 million shares. This is NPR News. Those three high-priced paintings stolen from New York's Kennedy Airport last weekend, the two Picassos and the Pissarro, officials now say the pictures are fakes. From member station WNYC, Laura Seidel reports.
Although the owner and apparently the thief believe that the three paintings were the work of Picasso and Pissarro, art experts hired by the FBI say they're fakes. Police had recovered the three stolen artworks and arrested a Kennedy Airport cargo handler and his accomplice, Evelina Espinoza Gonzalez, a construction businessman from Mexico who co-owns the works, says he flew in from Mexico with the paintings last Thursday. After declaring he had valuable artwork at U.S. Customs, he was told he had to leave the paintings overnight while paperwork was completed. When Gonzalez returned on Friday, They were gone. Police recovered the works in the basement of a Long Island apartment house owned by the girlfriend of one of the men charged in the theft. The FBI summoned art experts to determine if the works were real. The owner says he was bringing them to New York to have them assessed at Christie's and Sotheby's. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Seidel in New York.
A State Department official today warned China not to underestimate U.S. determination to protect Taiwan. At the same time, Assistant Secretary for Asian Affairs Winston Lord said he thinks China has no intention at this time to take military action against Taiwan. Lord mirrored Defense Secretary William Perry, who wouldn't say if an attack by China on Taiwan would provoke a U.S. military response. According to published reports, Russia confirms it will resume sales of high-performance jet fighters to the Chinese Air Force. The New York Times reports the sale involves 72 planes. Microsoft company said today it's discovered a new virus designed to attack its Windows 95 program. The virus is named after retired Lieutenant Colonel Hugo Chavez, who led a failed coup attempt in Venezuela 4 years ago. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Perhaps the biggest recent development in the cyber world is the phenomenal growth of the World Wide Web. My guest is the creator of the web, Tim Berners-Lee. The web is a global library of text, pictures, audio, and video that exists on the international computer network known as the Internet. Berners-Lee made it possible for us to get at this information without having to learn complicated computer languages. He also devised a system for linking related documents. He made the web so easy to access that everyone and everything seems to have a website now. Berners-Lee created the web prototype in 1989 while at a physics lab in Geneva, Switzerland. In 1994, he left to launch the World Wide Web Consortium at the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science, which creates standards and new software for the web. I asked Tim Berners-Lee what the web enables users to do that they couldn't do before.
Well, for many years before the web existed, there was a network of computers. And the network consists of cables and computers and things called routers, which connect the cables together. And to use it, you have to get onto a computer and learn a program to talk to the network and maybe use that program to talk to another computer. And when you've got talking to that other computer, you have to learn to use the program which is on that other computer. That was the situation. So that in order to use the ability of the network to move information from one place to another, you had to know all about it. What the web enables you to do is to see the information, which in fact is stored on computers, which are connected through the network, without being aware of how they're connected and which particular computers are involved. It just allows you to explore the information in an information space. The web is the universal space of information.
And you don't need to learn a specialized computer language to access it.
That's the whole idea, yes.
Now, what were your frustrations with the Internet before you created the World Wide Web?
I wouldn't say that I was particularly frustrated with the Internet. The Internet was a great thing. I found that the computing environment in general wasn't largely on the Internet. And also, of course, there's a terrible incompatibility that almost everything which you needed to know in your daily life was written down somewhere. And at the time, in the 1980s, it was almost certainly written down on a computer somewhere. Somebody had typed it in. They typed it into some computer somewhere. It may not have been connected, but even if it was connected, it was probably a different sort of computer. And to actually get that information onto your computer would take a lot of knowledge. It would probably involve going up the corridor to talk to a guru to ask him how to go connect to the network. And then when you connect it to the network, ask another guru how to talk to the other computer, and then maybe when you got talking to it, you'd probably have to type help a lot of times to get the information. And probably when you got it would be incompatible form and you wouldn't be able to display it on your own screen. So the whole thing was, it was a mess, and it was very frustrating that people's effort in typing it in was not being used. The information was not being used, when in fact, if it could only be tied together and made accessible, everything would be so much easier for everybody.
Now, did you set out trying to make accessible all the information on the Internet, or was your initial goal more modest than that?
Well, the initial goal wasn't to set out and make all the information available, but it was to create a space in which any information could be available, which is almost the same thing, but not quite. Clearly, any system which started off and only ran on one computer wasn't going to work. And any system which started off but would work with 100 documents or 1,000 documents but wouldn't be able to hold 100,000 documents wasn't going to work. I wanted a system which would work if I started using it in my group and somebody else started using it in another group on the other side of the planet, and we suddenly realized that we had some information that was related, that would allow us to, just by making a very simple link, connect those two together into one large information space without having to do something like take a tape with all the information from one system and cart it across to another computer and load it in and convert the format and merge the two databases.
Now, at the time you created the web, you were working at a European particle physics lab, yes?
Yes. Now, CERN, as it's known.
What was the prototype of the web that you created? What was the first thing resembling what has since become known as the web?
Well, the first thing which had web-like properties was a program I wrote called Enquire, which was short for Enquire Within Upon Everything, which was the title of a Victorian book which I'd seen, which had written to have everything about the Victorian household in it. And Enquire was like many computer programs into which you type information, apart from the fact that you could make random links from any piece of information to any other piece of information. So it didn't have hypertext at the time. It had a list of links at the bottom of each note. But you could make a note from any note to any note. There was no structure forced on you by the program. And I found that was very powerful. That was 1980. And then 1989, I wrote the prototype World Wide Web program, which was a GUI hypertext editor. You could write very much as into a word processor. You could type text and you could make headings and you could make links just as you might make headings by using hotkeys or using the mouse and menus.
I should ask you to explain what hypertext is.
Hypertext is just like text, apart from the fact that when you see a reference to something else, as you see always when you're reading the newspaper, for example, it says that continued on page 34 or see leader on page 18. When you read it on a computer screen where it says see the leader on page 18, you can, it's in blue or it's underlined or it's in a little box. You can click on it with the mouse. You move the mouse over it. You press the button. And behind the text, invisibly known to the computer but not to you, is the address of the thing it's referring to in a way that stored in a form that the computer can use to go and get it. So that may be just page 18 of the same newspaper, or it may be page 18 in somebody else's newspaper on the other side of the world. Whatever it is, you click on it. The computer goes and gets it and displays it on your screen. Sometimes it puts it up in place of what you're reading, or sometimes it opens a new window on your screen and puts it next to it so that you can see the two things together. Hypertext is the ability to take a link from anywhere to anywhere. When you read hypertext, it's a lot faster if you want to get at something. If you're reading an article which isn't really what you wanted to know, but it refers to something that is what you wanted to read about, then you can jump to that. You can jump and jump and jump to things more and more relevant until you find exactly what you want. So it's exciting from the reader's point of view. From the writer's point of view, when you're writing hypertext, you don't have to keep including information from other places. You can just put a link to it. If you want to refer to something you've written before, you want to refer to something which is out there, which somebody else has written, by putting a link, it enables people who don't know about it to go and find it. For example, if this was a hypertext talk, we could have just put a link on hypertext, and somebody clicking on that, reading the transcript, would be able to jump off, read all about hypertext without us having to take the time out to explain it. We would have been able to keep on with the main thread.
Right. My guest is Tim Berners-Lee. He created the World Wide Web and now directs the Web's consortium at MIT. So you spent several years with this program that you called Enquirer, using a World Wide Web type structure just for your own personal use. And then 8 years later or so, you started expanding it. What was the first step to letting other people know that you had actually hit upon something that could have an extraordinary international impact?
Well, I didn't exactly go around saying I've hit upon something which has had which could have an extraordinary international impact. The first step was to try to persuade the people at CERN that this would be a good thing to work on.
At the physics lab where you were working.
That's right. And I found that, in fact, quite difficult because a physics lab is a physics lab and you are supposed to do physics there rather than make global hypertext systems. But in 1989, my boss at the time, Mike Sendel, in fact, in 1990, I originally proposed it in 1989. In 1990, my boss at the time said, why not go ahead, try making a prototype? And so I did that in November of 1990. And then after Christmas, I showed the program to a few people around the lab and started using it myself and started using it with my colleague Robert Caillou, who was an enthusiast. And then in the summer, I put it onto a file transfer protocol, an FTP server, on the internet and mentioned it in a news group so that people across the internet could pick it up. And that spread through people who were using the Next machine, which was the machine I developed it on, a Next Step machine. And it spread through people who were interested in hypertext. So through those two communities and through the high energy physics community, it started to spread.
So basically, you put the software for free on the internet. You allowed people to take the software for free.
Yes, initially it was put out for free as experimental and interesting code for people to comment on. And then later on, when people started to use it very seriously, the question came up as to what the policy would be. And I spent 18 months persuading the CERN directorate that it ought to be made available generally for free and that it would help the world if CERN did not demand a license fee for its use.
That means that you did not make money off of the web, right?
I personally didn't make money off the web, no, and CERN didn't ask license fees for it.
You probably could have become a multi-gazillionaire, don't you think?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult to ask what would have happened if, isn't it? At the time, there was and there still is, a system called Gopher, which came out of the University of Minnesota. And at one point, the University of Minnesota decided that they'd reserve the right to demand license fees. And a lot of people suddenly dropped it. And they felt, oh, no, here we are jumping on a bandwagon. And in a little while, suddenly we'll be paying for it because somebody will then start tightening the stranglehold and we'll be paying. So with the web setting out as something which was universal, something which anybody could use, I felt was very important because it's no good having something which will run on any platform if, in fact, there is a proprietary hold on it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Berners-Lee, and he's the founder of the World Wide Web. He also directs the World Wide Web Consortium, which is based at MIT. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tim Berners-Lee, and he's the founder of the World Wide Web. I'm wondering what you envisioned when you created the web, and if you would compare that to what the web has become.
Well, I think from the diversity of information you find on the web when it comes to subject matter, I'm very happy with the way it's turned out, and that's very much what I like to see. I envisaged a universal space of information in which you could put anything, whether it is a picture of a beautiful medieval manuscript, or whether it is something which you just scribble down and really must tell your friends before you forget it. I feel that information of all these types, the scribbled note, the academic paper, the advertisement, even junk mail, there's all sorts of information in the world, there's all sorts of information on paper, all that sort of information should be possible on the web. And we're seeing quite a diversity in terms of subject matter. There's all sorts of weird things. What we're not seeing is the rather hasty information, the informal information. We're not seeing people use it so much in groups on the small scale to organize their thoughts. So what I'd like to have seen more would be groups of people, small groups, who share an understanding, building on that understanding and developing it, for example, in trying to solve a problem, by writing together a piece of hypertext which describes the problem, describes their solution, and by writing it together and taking turns editing pieces of it and making the links, building a common knowledge, a representation of that common knowledge. I thought that was a very exciting idea. I think we'll see a lot more of that in the future.
So the web has become more of a library, an information storage system. You wanted the software you created to also be used for a process that would help people solve problems
more interactively. Mm-hmm. I'd say. Mm-hmm. Allowing people to write and to make their own connections. That's the nice thing to do. Is as you're browsing through something which you're discussing with a friend, for example, and you realize that something that you saw the other day is relevant to this and could be answer to the problem. Say you click off, you go back to your homepage, and then you follow the links which take you to where you were. You press a button on your computer, you come back to the thing you're writing and say, and you write, "Hey, Jill, think about this." And you make a link, and then when she reads it, then she follows the link and ends up seeing just what you saw. And now you've connected together two pieces of knowledge, rather as in the brain, your mind builds connections between one thing and another. After a little while, something sort of clicks. You can put that click into the system, and other people can follow it.
Do you see any new creations that are just coming on the market or that are on the horizon that you think will change the web even further?
The web is certainly going to change. One of the things that we try to do at the consortium where we define the way computers talk to each other is to define it in the way that they will be able to start off talking one way, and then both computers will be able to adapt and talk in smarter ways and do smarter things as technology evolves. So we hope that we're not tying everybody down to a web which looks always as the web does today. Ooh. There are some exciting things. There's the three-dimensional representation, for example, which tends to need more power in your computer than two-dimensional representation. But as computers become more powerful, then that will become more commonplace. And maybe the computers themselves, instead of having a sort of flat desktop on your screen, it'll become a two-dimensional desktop with shelves you can put things on, and maybe people will find that easier to navigate in using a three-dimensional metaphor.
Explain more what you mean by three-dimensional. I'm a little confused.
Well, the screen is flat, mm-hmm. and most of the things you move around a computer screen are flat icons, and they look like flat sheets of paper, so the thing looks like a desktop seen from above. Mm-hmm. But there are some areas where even though the screen is flat, you get a three-dimensional picture, and using a joystick, for example, you can fly through it. So instead of giving somebody just a picture, a map of the university, a picture of the university appears on the screen, and you can move into it and fly through it and find different departments. So it's very fancy as virtual reality, it makes new science fiction worlds, but also it's very good for teaching, and also because our minds are good at remembering where we put things in three-dimensional space, perhaps it's a good way of organizing information. Perhaps we'll have a three-dimensional virtual house in which we put in which we can put little three-dimensional icons for things we found, and we'll find it easier to remember where things were.
What else do you see on the horizon for the web?
Well, there are a lot of very exciting things happening. One of them is the ability of a document to be active. We call it to be something which, in fact, is a little program. When you load a document from another computer, you follow a link, your browser software goes off, asks the other computer for a document, and it brings it back very much like a word processor file, and it puts it up on the screen. There's a possibility, however, for some of that file to actually be a little program which can then start running. So if you move over something like, for example, if you're teaching somebody about a physics experiment, you can move over a picture of the apparatus, which when you click on it, it actually starts to do things and bubble and click and whir, and you can watch what happens. Or it can be a simulation. It can be it can load down something which will produce you some video, some animation, something you can interact with. And that is potentially extremely interesting. It could turn into a very exciting world. You can imagine, for example, downloading going into a store and finding a shopping basket there, and then moving that little shopping basket and taking it around with you. And the shopping basket is there on the screen, and every time you drop something into it, effectively you're setting up to buy it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Berners-Lee, and he's the creator of the World Wide Web, the founder of it, and he also directs the World Wide Web Consortium at MIT. Now, we've already established that you did not like what copyright the web. Was that a possibility, copywriting it?
I don't think copyright would have been appropriate. Maybe there would have been patents one could have taken out.
Mm-hmm. On the software that you created, on the program that you created?
It would have been possible. There was a point after a couple of years that a lot of people were starting to use the web, not just for fun, not just in universities, but also companies were realizing that this was going to be an important part of how their organization worked, sometimes an important part of how their organization interacted with the outside world. There was, at one point, a computer company. Four people from that company came to my office unannounced, knocked on the door, came in, sat around the table, banged on the table and said, look, do you realize what resources we're putting into the web? What's going to happen to it? How do we know that it's going to be stable? How do we know that it's going to continue in the future as a basis for all our developments and all the commerce we're going to be doing? And I asked them what sort of thing they saw as a suitable way of taking the web forward. And I talked to a lot of people about it. I went on a trip around the States as well, asking universities, companies, other organizations, what they felt was a reasonable thing to do, and looking at a suitable place to base a new organization, and decided, and obviously at that point I wondered about starting a small company, or joining a large company for that matter, and the conclusion was that if the web was run by one proprietary interest, then there would be people who would never want to play. They would always want to start their own one in competition, because they would never want to want to be controlled by one proprietary group. So looking around, I needed somewhere which would be clearly vendor neutral, which would be a neutral place, a forum where all the interested parties could gather. And the computer science lab at MIT came out with checks in all the boxes there. They had already done that for the X Consortium. They set up a vendor neutral platform, and they had also got a good reputation for keeping programs, specifications which they developed available for the whole public. Anything from the X Consortium, the whole public, anybody in the public could get at, turn into a product, use for private use, no matter what. It was available, it was free for use, and that is how the standard became adopted. That is a very strong force to get everybody to work the same way. So I talked to the computer science lab people. Professor Michael de Tuzos was very keen about this. He was also very keen about setting up something in Europe as well, setting up an international body, which I, as a European, was interested in. We're both Europeans. And Albert Weser at the lab, who had helped organize the business model for various consortia in the past, also said he was happy to do that for the World Wide Web Consortium. And when you put that with the number of people there doing exciting research, sure, around the World Wide Web, and people who had, such as Dave Clark, who was at the lab, who was involved with the defining the TCP protocol. He's basically Mr. TCP/IP many days back in the dawn of the internet. It was clearly a great place to be based. So about 18 months ago, in September 1994, then we set that up. I came over, we set up a consortium, and people, companies of various sorts have been joining ever since. We now have getting on for 120, probably more.
Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web. He now directs the World Wide Web Consortium at the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ron Popeil's Golden Oldies. TV's most famous pitchman tells us about the early days, marketing such products as the Vegematic, Kitchen Magician, the Smokeless Ashtray, and Mr. Microphone. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews Primary Colors, and we continue our conversation with Tim Berners-Lee, creator of the World Wide Web. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with the creator of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee. The web is a library of text, pictures, audio, and video that exists on the global network of computers known as the Internet. Berners-Lee now directs the World Wide Web Consortium at the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science, which is creating standards for the web. I asked him to describe a typical problem the consortium is currently grappling with.
Imagine that there is a company which makes a browser software which you run on your machine and server software, and they thought of a nice smart thing they can do, such as moving from pages which you click on to be able to give you a complete presentation of a sequence of pages, for example. They decided that they want to move to putting video in instead of still images. Whatever it is, there's some fancy new thing. The first thing they do is they put it into their product and advertise that their product is the smartest on the market. And then very quickly, of course, all the other products adopt the same feature. But they adopt it in a slightly different way so that if you try to use the new feature from one person's browser to read information from another person's server, you get a mismatch. You get pages which you might have seen if you've been browsing the web, which say, really, this page is best seen using this particular sort of software. And that means that the World Wide Web, when that happens, is becoming less worldwide. It's starting to become a proprietary area. It's starting to become the case that if you give somebody a point of some information, you don't know whether they'll be able to follow it. So what
they'd
happens
have to buy
then,
access to it.
They'd have to, well...
They'd have to buy different software.
Now, that's it's crazy to have. Can you imagine having, instead of one World Wide Web browser, having 12 World Wide Web browsers?
Right. Now, can you prevent that from happening? How can you prevent that from happening?
We can prevent that from happening by then going to the companies and saying, look, now you don't have a competitive advantage by having something which is, now that everybody has this, let's decide on a way that we'll do it all together. So that we can build on this, so that instead of fighting about exactly how we'll do it and having these incompatibilities which reduce the power of the whole system, let's decide that this is a done deal now. We know that we can do this. Let's do it in a standard way, and let's release that as a public specification so that anybody could do it that way. And then let's go on and invent the next thing. Let's go on and look at all the exciting things we can do using that new feature.
That sounds great, but the profit motive is really strong. What authority do you have to tell a company that, you should really do something universal?
We have no authority at all. However, this is a win-win situation that we have to rely on the fact that being incompatible is no fun for any company. It's a very bad mark to be incompatible with the standards. It's a very bad mark to have people to say, please don't use this particular browser on this page because it really won't work properly. So in fact, what happens is that when the moment it's not really, really the leading edge of what they feel is their most exciting feature for the next version, companies are quite happy to sit around the table, and there are a number of draft specifications which we've released recently, which illustrate that.
So the World Wide Web Consortium has basically the power of persuasion. is that the power that you have to regulate the web?
That's right. We're funded by our members, by those companies that we're trying to persuade. So we feel that if they didn't want us to persuade them, they wouldn't have started the consortium in the first place.
So you feel that everybody has a vested financial interest in keeping the web open, and that's one of the things that's going to allow the web to stay open.
Yes, in the end, because the web itself is not, in fact, it's not the end of all things. The web is a means. The web is an exciting information space. We're developing it to make it richer. But what's interesting is what you do with it. What mm-hmm. is interesting are the programs that you have on the clever clients, the clever servers, the totally new applications when you start doing financial transactions across the internet, when you start seeing three-dimensional things, when you have beautiful educational worlds, that all the applications that you produce on top of that will be enabled by the richness of the web and by the way it interoperates. If a company tries to go out by itself and be separate and be individual and not interoperate with the rest of the world, then unless they can corner the entire market and persuade everybody who's buying software and buying information that that's a good idea, then they'll look very silly if, in fact, the rest of the world gets together and decides to do it in a common way.
As we've said before, you decided not to patent the programs or the software that you came up with to create the World Wide Web. But now that the World Wide Web exists, everybody's trying to make money from it. And, you know, more and more people are entering the web in the hopes that if not now, tomorrow, they'll be able to make a buck. What do you think of the growing commercialization within the web?
What do you mean by that? Do you mean advertising sites?
Exactly. More and more advertising sites, more and more people trying to use the web to sell things. But I think in a way, lots and lots of advertising. There's more and more home pages that have sponsors. There's online magazines that have more advertisers on them. Plus, there's a lot of websites that really are no more than public relations vehicles for the company that opened the web page.
Right. Well, let's go back to a couple of things, important points about the web. One is it's universal. So we expect to see all kinds of stuff out there. And I wouldn't want to limit it, just as you wouldn't want to limit paper. Imagine you'd invented paper. Would you say, this is great for printing on, you can print on it, you can write on it, but you can't advertise on it? Then there would just be, you'd be trying to tweak society by changing the medium. The medium has to be neutral. Medium has to be universal. So there's a lot of advertising out there. The second interesting thing about the web is that unlike electronic mail or junk mail, any kind of mail, it doesn't jump out at you. You only get information which you've asked for by following a link. So if you have found a lot of sites with advertising on and you didn't like it, then you don't have to go back there again. You don't have to tell people about it when you write articles. You don't have to put hypertext links to them. You may feel that it's, in fact, you'd prefer to put pointers to information which doesn't have advertising on it. You can do that. It's a free world. Your readership will choose. People may decide that, in fact, your article isn't interesting because you're not pointing to the interesting things. The interesting things do, in fact, happen to have advertising on it, but they'll take it. And, in fact, of course, advertising on the web, compared with advertising on television, is much less painful in that the only thing you have to see is a little banner with the name of the product. And if you want the details, then you can click on it. So you're already selecting, and the people who are interested in the advertisement are the people who see the hard sell. All the other people have to see is the little icon, the little banner. So in fact, I find that it's quite a nice compromise.
Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web and now directs the World Wide Web Consortium at the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science. Coming up, it dices and slices. This is Fresh Air. You know my guest from TV. He's tried to sell you the Vegematic, the Popeil Pocket Fisherman, the Smokeless Ashtray, and Mr. Microphone. Yes, it's Ron Popeil. Sure, you may have laughed at how tacky his ads sound, but they made him a millionaire several times over. Now he gets to stretch out in the more leisurely format of the infomercial, where he's been selling a hairspray to fill in bald spots and a food dehydrator.
Over here, we got dried, we're drawing strawberries and cantaloupe and honeydew and watermelon, and we can do papaya. Yes, you can dry watermelon with the machine too, seeds and all.
Look they at just, this!
Yeah, the only key thing here is slice your food thin. That's the key thing for making this machine really work with high performance. Slice the food, and here we're drying watermelon, we've done papaya, mangoes, cantaloupe, honeydew.
Look at the strawberries. Are strawberries dried wonderful?
You know what you use that for? You take those sliced strawberries, throw them on some yogurt or cereal in the morning. Absolutely delicious.
Ron Popeil isn't shy about selling his products or himself. His new book is called Salesman of the Century. He learned to sell by demonstrating products at flea markets and at Woolworths back in the 1950s. I asked him what he sold there.
Oh, lots of products. I sold a plastic plant kit that was artificial foliage was a big thing in the 50s, and we developed a product that came out of a tube. It was called Plastisol. It was green in color. You can have it white in color, and we had these little molds that were aluminum of different shape leaves, like ivy, philodendron, nephritis. I learned all those things, and you could just take the Plastisol, put it in this mold. Put the mold on top of a toaster or a electric burner, drop a cloth wire in it, and make a leaf in a minute's time. And after you made a bunch of leaves, I learned how to put the leaves together and make it into a plant. Put the plant in a pot, and you had a beautiful artificial foliage.
When you were demonstrating on the street or at Woolworths, what were your demonstrations like? Would you do one for us verbally?
Well, I can't do one without the product in front of me. But most of the products were housewares-type products, like food choppers and slicers and things of that nature. And I would normally say, if I was chopping onions, I would say, or using my food slicer, I would say that the food slicer blade was so sharp that you could slice an onion so thin it only had one side. Or when tomatoes got expensive in the wintertime, you could slice a tomato so thin you'd make one tomato last you all winter long. Or this knife was so sharp that you could cut a cow in half, and that's no bull. We had wonderful lines that we developed a long time ago. Every demonstration basically was showing the consumer the old-fashioned way of doing it, whether we had an old rusted knuckle buster in the house.
Like a cheese grater or something.
Yeah, one of those old knuckle busters. It was a stand-up kind of product. Versus using my particular product that accomplished the same thing very easily, easy to clean, and the price was right.
Now, the first item you advertised on TV was?
A product called the spray gun, the Ronco spray gun.
And what did it do?
Most folks remember it. It was, remember the nozzle, any nozzle that fits on the end of a garden hose, but this was gun-shaped, and it held a tablet. A soap tablet to wash your car or second-story window, a wax tablet if you were doing your car, and then we added a fertilizer tablet, a weed killer, and an insecticide tablet. And the water passed this chamber that held the tablet. And, of course, if you had a soap tablet, soapy, forceful water would shoot out. You could turn off the chamber so that water would pass directly passing the tablet without picking up any of the tablet, so you'd have a rinsing effect. I made that commercial. In fact, I was working in a Woolworth store in Chicago, and a friend of mine told me that I could, in fact, and of course it's in my book, The Salesman of the Century.
Salesman just got the book title in.
Oh, yep, that's one. Didn't expect me not to do that. Told me that I could make a commercial, a TV commercial down in Florida at a television station for $550. Within 1 week, I was on a plane down there, and I made the commercial for $550. I used a friend's house, my friend's car, And the product was overwhelmingly successful.
It sold.
It sold, yes.
Okay, now the second ad you did on TV was for the Chop-O-Matic.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, why don't we hear the ad?
If you want to chop a few celery stalks, you know, for soup, salad, or stuffing, instead of wasting time cutting the celery with a knife like you usually would, just place your celery under the chopper with a few taps of the palm of the hand. See how easy it is? Just like bouncing a ball, and in seconds your celery is chopped. Here's a way to make a hurry-up supper. Make some of those mouth-watering hash brown potatoes. Just place the potatoes under the chopper a few times, a few seconds, and there's your hash brown. They're ready for the pan. What could be easier? Of course, if you have an appetite for potato pancakes, you just continue tapping. I'll show you pancakes that are so fine, they won't fall apart or be tasteless or rubbery as when you grate them. And just look how fine they are. You add an egg and some onion and fry them to a golden brown. This is certainly a welcome sight for any hungry man.
Now, I have to say, your voice on that ad almost sounds like a circus barker. There's a certain
yes.
kind of melodious, you know, mm-hmm. the way you're asking questions and then answering them. It sounds like you're inviting people into the tent or something.
Well, when in fact you are demonstrating product, there's so much you have to say and people are in a hurry. Don't forget, people who stopped to buy my product didn't come to see me to buy the product. They were there to buy something else. What we had to do, or what I had to do, was stop them, create an interest, and have them go down in their purse or pockets and take out money and buy a product they had no interest in buying in the first place.
Now, where did the Chop-O-Matic come from?
Chop-O-Matic was developed by my father. My father was an inventor of consumer products. Most of his products, your listener would be aware of, the Veg-O-Matic was his invention. I did the television marketing on it. Chop-O-Matic was another one, and of course, the big one, Veg-O-Matic, was a very big item for him. But he used to use me as his, although I didn't work for him, I was one of his biggest customers, and he used to use me to sell his product, and he would send down his customers to watch me work, whether it be at a flea market, of which at those days was Maxwell Street in Chicago, or the Woolworth store. And I was always have his customers in my audience watching me sell tons and tons of product, watching this money change hands. And he developed a lot of customers that way.
Now, the Chop-O-Matic you were selling back when this ad was made, which was, what, the 1960s sometime?
Early 60s, yes.
Okay, you were selling it for $5.98, but for this TV presentation, order right now, $3.98, and a special bonus, a valuable recipe book with 50 secret recipes by world-famous
chefs.
Yes.
Right.
Now, how does this work? You know, it's $5.98, but if you order now, it's $3.98. Were you really selling it for $5.98 and knocking off a couple bucks?
In some places. I don't think that's much difference today than what everyone is aware of what is the suggested retail price.
Mm-hmm.
The suggested retail price is a price that car manufacturers use. We use it in our business. And we do, in fact, sell a lot of product at that price. But we all know that the suggested retail price is a price that you can come down from. And everyone wants to buy something for, quote, less than retail. And so it's a deal. And we even go beyond that by giving some other goodies away with it. We'll add on some other ancillary products.
What's the most successful TV ad you've ever done?
I would think it's misleading because of the medium, and that's because of the infomercial business. And the food dehydrator is about $200 million in sales in the past 4 years.
Okay, now let's leave out the infomercials. What's the most successful?
Then I would have to think that... Are you going to talk about dollars or units? Because if you go back 40 years, then...
You got me there. Units.
Units. Units, I would say Veg-O-Matic. Then Mr. Microphone. Then the smokeless ashtray. Then the Ronco clean air machine. Those items were big. Buttoneer was a giant item as well. The problem with buttons is they always fall off. The problem with buttons is they always fall off, and when they do, don't sew them on the old-fashioned way with needle and thread. Get a buttonniere. The new automatic button fastener makes a great Christmas gift.
Now, this is part of your philosophy, right? That every product needs to respond to a problem, needs to be the solution to a problem.
That's in most cases. There was one exception in my life, and that was Mr. Microphone.
One of your inventions.
Yes.
Actually, I'm going to pause here and play a Mr. Microphone ad.
Hey, this Christmas party is getting a little too quiet. I think it's time we liven it up with my favorite Christmas gift, Mr. Microphone.
Hey, what's that?
Well, you set the dial on your FM radio and testing.
These kids are having a fabulous time with Mr. Microphone, the cordless microphone that actually puts your voice on the radio. There are no attaching wires, so you're free to move around. Broadcast over any FM car radio.
Hey, good looking, we'll be back to pick you up later.
Now, that hey, good looking, were you being funny or serious there? Did you really expect people would go cruising along with their Mr. Microphone picking up chicks?
I thought that it would be used for that purpose. And I thought people would find it very, very unique and remember it. And I was right.
Now, why did you invent Mr. Microphone? I mean, what was on your mind when you invented Mr. Microphone?
I think I had come in contact with some people who were talking about their grandchildren. And they were grandmothers, a couple of them that I knew. And they were talking about how their one was a grandson and a granddaughter. And they were talking how they had great voices and they had... They were going to be singers, and I guess singing in then was big time for children, or as perceived by grandparents or mothers. And then I know that I had occasionally, when I was taking a shower, would sing in the shower and get that echo. I said, well, maybe there's something really here. And this was an electronic toy. It could be made very inexpensively. And for those out there listening that didn't know what a Mr. Microphone or how it worked, basically it was just a microphone. Well-designed, had an orange top, black handle, had a little wire sticking down about a foot long. It was cordless and wireless, and you could turn on any FM radio in the world to 88.3 on the FM dial, and you could hear yourself coming through the radio. So the product not only had domestic use here in the United States or Canada, but all over the world. And it was inexpensive to make, and people remember the commercial. It was just a great, great holiday gift.
Ron Popeil, his book is called Salesman of the Century. Coming up, a review of the political novel that has everybody guessing. This is Fresh Air. Washington is buzzing over the question of who wrote Primary Colors, the new political romana clef that gives a behind-the-scenes glimpse of the Clinton presidential campaign. But book critic and Washingtonian Maureen Corrigan says there's more to Primary Colors than just the question of who done it.
The Washington Post ran a poll last week that told us, among other things, that approximately 40% of Americans surveyed did not know the name of the vice president. Given this revelation, I think it's safe to assume that most of the country is not quite as obsessed with the question of who wrote Primary Colors as we Washingtonians are. Not since the 1920s, when some renegade scholars first declared that the Earl of Oxford was the real author of Shakespeare's plays, has this much public attention, at least in Washington, been devoted to the question of literary authorship. Personally, I don't have a theory about the identity of Anonymous. This means that, though I've seen George Stephanopoulos sweating at my health club, and I've stood behind Cokie Roberts on the supermarket checkout line, I'm not really a Washington insider. I'll confess, I don't even recognize the names of many of the primary suspects for authorship of Primary Colors. Who on earth is Carter Wilkie? And Roger Altman, didn't he make Nashville? But the fact that even an outside-the-beltway type like myself had a blast reading Primary Colors tells you it's not a novel whose appeal is limited only to pundits, policy wonks, and political junkies. Rather, Primary Colors is by turns a witty and appalling account of the dreams, deceits, and swamp gas that propel the American presidential race. Our guide into this netherworld is Henry Burton, the grandson of a Martin Luther King-like civil rights martyr who becomes the assistant campaign manager to presidential candidate Jack Stanton. Henry succumbs to Stanton's good old boy charisma and his idealism. But even at their first meeting, Henry recognizes that Stanton's concern for his fellow Americans is simultaneously earnest and forced. Here's Henry's description of Stanton in what he calls his heavy listening mode, working a crowd of voters. "It is the most aggressive listening the world has ever known, aerobic listening. It is an intense, disconcerting phenomenon, as if he were hearing quicker than you can get the words out, as if he were sucking the information out of you." Stanton is flanked by his savvy, headbanded wife Susan and a horny hillbilly media consultant who, quote, "looks like he was sired during the love scene from Deliverance." James Carville must be thrilled with that description. As the Stanton campaign marches bloodied but unbowed through the New Hampshire and New York primaries, the energetic Stanton bounds through union halls and appears on radio talk shows like Schmooze for Jews. He also faces off with wickedly depicted Mario Cuomo and Paul Tsongas lookalikes. The first two-thirds of Primary Colors follows the Clinton campaign pretty closely, which gives the novel its delicious insider appeal. The drawback, however, is that when the campaign hits a slump, so does the plot. But towards the end, Anonymous finally lets his or her imagination rip. Henry, whose faith in Stanton has rapidly eroded, is offered one last reason to believe in him. Is Stanton a redeemed sinner or a master manipulator? Would his presidency make history or flounder in politics as usual? Henry's own sense of decency, as well as his vision of America, rides on his decision whether to stick with Stanton. As climaxes go, this one has all the stomach-churning tension of that classic suspense story moment where the bomb expert has to decide which wire to cut. Choose the right one, and everybody breathes a sigh of relief. Snip the other, and the whole place is blown to kingdom come.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.